Erev Tov, everybody. A pleasure to welcome back Achron Achron Chaviv or Chaviva. So part three of our three-part series with Michelle Chesner, who will be speaking on the book. That has basically a book. It's really a pleasure to have her. And I think a unique topic and one that I find, you know, a fascinating topic. And I think you're going to discuss really the impact of the book today. I don't even remember the exact title. And then I think you promised you're going to tell a little bit your personal story, how you got into this field. So, Bavakasha.
Thank you. Can everybody see my slideshow? I know we had a problem last time. Okay, so now we're going to talk about a topic near and dear to my heart, which, like I said last time, goes into why I became a librarian to begin with. So early print as a hidden archive, tracing the footprints in Jewish books. This is really the meat of what I do and why I love what I do. So forgive me if I go on. But let's just do an overview of what we're going to be talking about. So just a basic introduction to what I call footprints. So what? Why do we care about this? We'll go into a little bit of a deep dive into history as we find it in books. We'll talk about censors and silver linings, as promised last time. And then, as usual, finding the hidden people of the past. So where are we going to find all of these people? So I'll start with a book at Columbia University. It's Yitzchak Alfasi's Halachot Gedolot. It's sort of halachic bestseller. This one printed in Krakow in 1597. I'd like to point you to where it says 1778. The word before it actually is August, and you might be able to recognize this word as Kaniti. So the owner is writing that they bought this book in August of 1778. In fact, he writes here in Yiddish, it is now August of 1778. And then he writes, 181 years ago, it was printed. And this, to me, accurately encompasses what I feel like when I pick up a book from the 15th century in my collection, when I pick up a book from the 10th century in my collection, or in any collection. You look at a book and you say, wow, this was printed 181 years ago, or 500 years ago, or it was written 1,000 years ago. But in 1778, people felt that way as well. So this is, and enough that they felt like they had to write it on the book itself about the age of the book. So I see books as an entry into the past, a way that you can connect to the people of the past. And here's where you get a quick glimpse of my autobiography, which is that when I was a junior in college, I was trying to figure out what I should do with a degree in history, not a very practical degree, but one that I knew, loved what I was doing. And so I had an internship that summer at the Baltimore Hebrew University, which is now, their collection is now part of Towson University in Maryland. And my job was to look at the books that were uncatalogued and to identify them for cataloging. So I had to take down the title, the author, the date of printing, the place of publication of these old books. So they were all rare books. I opened one book, which was an 18th century commentary on the Talmud. And I saw in the book was annotations of an owner who had clearly studied the book and used it well. Also in the book was a stamp from the Volozhin Yeshiva in Eastern Europe. So it had been used in a center of Torah study. And then I turned a page and I saw the stamp of the Nazi archives. And I had sort of a jolt. And then I turned to the front of the book and there was a book plate from the Jewish Cultural Reconstruction Project. The Jewish Cultural Reconstruction Project came out as a result of the massive caches of looted art and books and other materials that were found by the Allied forces after World War II of materials that was stolen by the Nazis. And they found millions of books, of Jewish books that had been stolen. And the Jewish Cultural Reconstruction was a commission that came together to try and return the books to the Jewish people, whatever that meant. And it meant different things to different people, and it was complicated. But back to the book that I was looking at, I realized that I had to become a librarian and I had to deal with books for the rest of my life, because if I cared about history, the closest way to get to the people of the past is to look at their history. So looking at this single book that I held in my hands, I had the story of a young man in a yeshiva studying and analyzing the words he was studying, of maybe his or somebody else's experience as the Nazis came in either to the yeshiva or to his house or whatever it was, took the book, added it to a pile on a wagon, most likely, took the time to stamp it, to accession it into a collection. And then it ended up in this cache where the U.S. Army then found it and moved it to another cache in Offenbach, where it was then ultimately sent to Baltimore. And so to me, I realized that books tell are the closest way to get to the people of the past. And that is that was something I had to stay in and stay learning about. So ultimately, libraries are insights into worlds. And that's something that I feel very strongly about. I just want to open the chat so I can give you all sorts of links. As Avriel Bar-Levav has an entry on libraries and the collecting of Jewish books in the Encyclopedia of Jewish Book Cultures. And he shows how libraries provide insights into the worlds of the people of the past. Judah ibn Tibbon, for instance, was from a family of translators. He wrote an ethical will for his son Samuel, which included a long section on the importance of libraries, which included things like check the order, the condition, rebind of your books, rebind loose leaves, call in your loaned books. If you lend out your books, you should call them in twice a year on Passover and Sukkot. But we don't know what was in his library. We do know that the father was very disappointed with his son's lack of use of his extensive collection. He included that in the ethical will. But we know that libraries have been so important for so long. And if you're interested in this ethical will, which includes a fascinating discussion of Judah ibn Tibbon and 12th and 13th century book collecting, I strongly recommend Sarah Pierce's book, which I put the link in the chat there. Levi ben Gershon, so Gersonides, did tell us what was in his libraries, including how he organized it. So we learn from other individuals what was in their libraries and what books they found were important. And we see this throughout the generations. By the 16th century, every Jewish house, I should say, this was not the case with their Christian neighbors. Every Jewish house in Italy had at least 1 to 10 books. And I'll explain a bit later why we know that fact. Shifra Bar Sennarbib writes about this and shows her evidence, which again, we'll discuss a bit later. So again, books were critical. And if we look at the books, then we can understand more about the people that own them. And I hope that by the time you've gotten to this point with me, you feel that, you understand that. So what is footprints? So this is a visualization that comes out of the footprints database, which is part of a project that I co-direct. It tracks the who, the where, and the when of Jewish printed books. And in so doing, it tracks the Jews. The purpose of footprints, what we're looking for in footprints, is everything that happens to a book after it comes off the printing press. So last week we talked about some evidence for histories that are printed in a book. Footprints starts from the moment printing ends and ownership or all sorts of other things happen. What is a footprint? So we define a footprint as a reconstruction by a researcher of a moment in time when we can place a book copy in a particular place and or with a particular person, such as an owner, a librarian, someone seeing the book, a giver, a subscriber, a censor, or many different kinds of people. How do we find this information? So this is exactly what I've been talking about. We have all sorts of different kinds of evidence that we're looking for, such as stamps, owner's inscriptions. We have auction catalogs. We have correspondence that talks about the buying and selling books. All of this comes together to gather all of this information. So then the question is, so what? Why do we need to do this? Why should anybody care about this? So I'm going to go through a whole bunch of examples to try and convince you as to why, and not to convince you, but really to show you what we can learn. There's the richness of what we can learn by looking a little bit more closely at early printed books. So for instance, we talked about printing at Rome in the 15th century. Here we have a copy of the Mishneh Torah printed in Rome. It was the second set of books printed at Rome between 1471 and 1473. And as you can see here, the Italian owner used this book extensively, even though it was what we would see and even what an 18th or 19th century owner would see as a rare book by the 18th and certainly the 19th century. Books printed in the 15th century were viewed as rare books. But this owner, who probably lived in the 15th or 16th century, to him it was just a book. And so he was using a book as he would any other book. And so we find his annotations throughout this book. On the other hand, we have another book printed in the 15th century with later additions. So these descriptions, which actually talk about the history of printing, because this is a very early Hebrew, a book printed in the very early eras of Hebrew printing. And both of these pages, I should add, are in manuscript. So these are both handwritten. These are bound in at the beginning of the book. So the owners, because these are two different handwritings, the owners of these books didn't want to write, to mark up the ancient text of the book itself. So they added these extra leaves talking about the history of printing in the books. And if we look very closely, this is actually that poem that I read to you last week about printing and how amazing it is, as it is in the Arba Aturim that was printed in Pieve di Sacco. Even though this is a totally different book, this is the Nofet Tzufim, but the owner was really interested in 15th century printing. And so they copied this information into a different book as part of sort of their history of printing that they wanted to include in this book. Another thing we can see is the history of Jews and science. This is a copy of Avicenna's Canon of Medicine. So this is a medical text. And this particular one includes, again, from the 15th century. This one includes annotations in both Roman characters, as you see here, and in Hebrew characters throughout. So what are Jews studying? What are they analyzing? And again, we can see this here, and looking at these texts can teach us information about their thoughts on the matter, potentially their additions on the matter. Art. So in this case, the first page, which has a decorated frame, as you can see here, was missing for this particular book. So the owner of the book copied the entire frame by hand in order to include that art in the book, even though they were missing the first page. I just want to point out this blank space here, which was for a decorated initial, because following after illuminated manuscripts, the very first printed books often expected that the owner would have the beginning of the text illustrated by hand. And so the word Bereshit is supposed to be written over here in beautiful illustration. And in fact, in this copy of the same book, it was. And again, this is a printed copy that has been colored, painted actually, by hand. So all of this decoration is in the print, was printed. This wasn't. This whole thing was added by hand, but this whole frame was printed. And then the owner colored in the book. So we can get a sense of art by looking at our art of particular periods, by looking at what is added in what kind of art is added in to printed book. We can think about the use of particular texts. So here we have a copy of a volume from Columbia's Bamberg Talmud. So again, this is the first complete edition of the Talmud printed by Daniel Bamberg. And we are, the conservator at Columbia has identified this binding as from Northern Italy in the mid 16th century. So I know that this set of books, we have a number of the volumes, were bought almost immediately after printing and then bound in the same place that they were printed in Venice. And then they traveled together as they were all bound together. So they somehow moved together as well throughout the centuries, which, as I'll discuss in a little while, is very, very unusual for Talmuds, and especially for Talmuds originating in Italy. What else can we learn from looking at books? So this is from the same set of the Bamberg Talmud. You can see here these little markings saying, hey, you should look at the margin, and it says Eof. This is what's called Masoret HaShas. So this is the citations in the Gemara text itself. There's a quote from somewhere else in Tanakh, usually. And on the side of a modern Gemara, you'll have that actual citation. In the Bamberg Talmud, that wasn't written down, but you see that the owner wanted it to be written, which can inform us as to why printers made the changes they did. It's, to today's view, it's obvious that we would want to have that information. But we can actually see almost in practice the usage of these books and why printers would then make changes to them, would incorporate changes to them that would because of user demand. Another example that we have here also from the Columbia book is the Shita Mekubetzet. So this is Bezalel Ashkenazi's commentary on the Talmud, which is not on the main text of the Talmud. It's often in the back. But in this case, the user of the book wanted it on the page itself. And so they wrote the entire commentary around the text over here of the Talmud. And this seems to be from the school of Bezalel Ashkenazi. There's been a little bit of work done on this phenomenon. There are a number of known editions of the Bamberg that include the Shita Mekubetzet on the page like this. What else can we learn from looking closely at these books? Well, what about women and the use of books? We have many, many examples. So, for instance, we have a commentary on Avicenna's canon that also includes, that's at the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, that also includes a list of books owned by this woman named Rachel, who clearly had some connection to medicine if she's writing in this work on medicine, and also has an extensive list of the books that she owned. So what can we do here? And I can give you a citation to the article that talks about it. It's in French, so forgive me if you don't read French, but it is there. And the original manuscript actually has been digitized by the BNF, and it's available online. In this case, we have a crossed out loan because it was repaid that was given out by Reislin, the daughter of Freskia, and the person who was borrowing the money gave her a copy of Yona Ashkenazi's Isser V'Heter, printed in Ferrara in 1555, as security against the loan. The loan was a half thaler, and the loan was on March 2nd, 1575. So a book was considered property. Somebody could give a book as security for a loan because it was worth that much money. We see women in philanthropy. Michla Bat Yochanan donated this book. It's a Talmud, Masachet Sukkah, to the Ashkenazic Beit Midrash Itzchaim in Amsterdam. And actually, there's wonderful work actually on Sephardi women in Amsterdam donating books and collections to books and other materials to the yeshivot in Amsterdam. And I'm gonna just give you that citation. Tirza Levy Bernfeld has done really tremendous research in this area. What about women reading? So we have Bela Bat Zalman, who's reading a book that's currently at Goethe University in Frankfurt. This is a Yiddish commentary on the Book of Esther. And that book is digitized over at the Goethe University. Then we have this one. This is a midrash that on which Miriam Bat Avraham writes her name on the front pages, on Midrash Shochar Tov, printed in Prague in 1613. So we have all these little sort of snippets of people that otherwise we would never know about. Thinking about Madam Mithla over here, they took the time to actually print a plate, just like we would print a modern book plate in our books. But that involved a printing press. They were printing multiple plates. So was Mithla a donor of multiple books? These are all questions that we can start to ask when we look really carefully at these books. What else? When we start to look more closely at these books, we can see missing books. So here's an example where Audrey Offenberg, who was an amazing scholar in the 20th century, I think I mentioned him last week. He wrote an article detailing books missing from European institutions following World War II. And you can see here that the, I think it was the 1488, Ibn Ezra, that was printed in Naples, was missing from the seminary, the Jewish Theological Seminary at Breslau. And then we have a copy of Shimon Yakerson's catalog of Hebrew incunabula at the Jewish Theological Seminary with a record for the exact same book with a stamp from the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau. So that book actually is no longer missing. We have found it, and here's its new location. So and another example, Ellie Genauer, who is a wonderful collaborator with us. He shares data from his collection with us about footprints in his collection. He found a stamp for Shmuel David Jakubovich, who continued the research to find that this person actually was killed. He found the Yad Vashem testimony saying that he was killed, but he didn't stop there. The book that he had was a book from Prague, 1701. He actually did further research until he found an heir of the book. And he took the time to find the heir, to contact him and to say, I have your relative's book and I would like to return it to you. And so this relative was able to have a physical copy of something that when he had nothing from the original library. Jean Matanki, who's a scholar of Kabbalistic literature, alerted me to this book in Columbia's collection also. And the annotations are from Ezra De Fano, who's a 16th and 17th century rabbi and Kabbalist, and in Mantua. And here again, we can learn so much about intellectual history by reading these annotations, by seeing what people are writing in particular books. So we can learn a tremendous amount there. And also just basic history. So we have, for instance, an example of religious life in early America in the mid 19th century, actually literally during the years of the Civil War, an itinerant Moahel named Nota Grumbach moved to America, and from between 1853 and 1867, he traveled to all of these places where he did milah. He did ritual circumcision for babies that had been born since his last visit. So we can learn about religious life, as I wrote, religious life in early America, how people were practicing. In another example, we have four volumes bound together in one book. So all of these essays are bound together, which tells us that the owner of the book was very interested in having all of these works together. So they must be connected to one another. When you look at the texts of the works, which are both in manuscript, this one is handwritten, and in print, you can see that they all refer to the episode around Nechemiah Yechiyun, who was a follower of Sabbateanism, of Shabtai Tzvi, even after he died. There were those who continued following his ideas. And he was in Amsterdam. There was a huge upheaval in Amsterdam when he arrived there, and there was a tremendous amount of work that was printed, that was written and printed around this whole controversy. But putting it all together in one work gives us sort of the mindset of the owner at a particular time, that they needed all of this together at their fingertips in one book in order to deal with potentially what was going on at that moment. We have names and family histories. There are so many people that we learn about who otherwise have sort of disappeared from existence. So this is a list of children who were born, family members who were born and died in the Almansi family. And the initial writing is by Baruch Almansi, who was the patriarch. And then you see that the handwriting changes to that of Giuseppe Almansi, his son, because his father has died. And actually the facing page of this book is this one, which is a eulogy for his father who has died. And this is in a machzor. This is sort of something, a book that the family would have kept, because a machzor is something, the prayer book for the holidays is something that everybody had. And so this is something in which you can also record family history, because you know it's something that you're gonna keep for a long time. Names have brought up a lot of questions for us, for those of us working on this project, because we're uncovering so much information, so much data about the people of the past. And there are other projects that are bringing up data about historical Jews also in other ways. And we talk about, we haven't quite figured out how to do it yet, but electronically linking all of these things together, you have something like Jewish Gen, which lists dates of birth and death of people, or any of these genealogy websites. And in the meantime, we're uncovering additional information. So how can we bring all of this disparate data together into one place where we can do these kinds of searches and learn more about the people of the past, especially the individual lives, which is something that we're uncovering through this particular project. Okay, so this brings me to this question of censorship. Before I get to censorship, I need to tell you a little bit of a story in order to give you the background to why censorship, why Catholic Church censorship in the 16th century onward existed, because there were certainly other kinds of censorship. So in 1550, Mayor Ben Isaac Katznellenbogen of Padua, who was also known as the Maharam Padua, produced a new edition of the Mishneh Torah, Rambam's Maimonides' work of halacha, of Jewish law. This was a huge endeavor. He worked with manuscripts, he worked with some of the earlier printed books, and he wrote an entirely new annotation commentary to help people be able to study this work. He initially went to the printer Mark Antonio Giustiniani to print his work, but for some reason, Giustiniani did not print his work. Instead, he went to Alvise Bragadini, or Bragadin, who established a new press for the sole purpose of printing this book. Bragadin then became a printer of Hebrew books, so it wasn't the only book he printed. But Giustiniani was a longstanding printer in Venice in the 16th century. He actually had inherited Daniel Bomberg's press, and he sort of had a monopoly. He was pretty furious when this happened. So he printed this exact same work, including the Maharam Padua's annotations, plus an introduction saying, well, I printed his annotations, but they're not really that good anyway. Plus he announced that he was going to charge one gold coin less than Bragadin's charge price for the book. As you can imagine, this made the Maharam Padua, Mr. Bragadin, pretty upset. The Maharam Padua decided to deal with this in a halachic manner. He went to Rabbi Moshe Isserles, also known as the Ramah, who was a rabbi in Krakow, who was actually fairly young at the time, who issued a ruling saying that it was forbidden to buy Justiniani's edition because it was a form of theft to produce his work. And for more information on this whole controversy and a tremendous amount on the legal, the halachic implications of the book, I cannot recommend enough Neil Weinstock-Netanel's book From Maimonides to Microsoft, which goes into the halachic implications of copyright and especially this case and how these questions were addressed from the beginning of print onward. Justiniani was pretty angry. Again, he was angry. And his tactics hadn't worked because once you have a rabbi say it's forbidden to buy a work, most Jews are going to be like, okay, so we're not going to buy the work. So he hired a convert to read through the Mishneh Torah published by Bragadin and to find offensive passages that were offensive to Christianity, which he then brought to the church. This then led to a whole study of Jewish texts and their heretical nature as regards the Catholic Church. And ultimately, on September 9th, 1553, which was also Rosh Hashanah, the Talmud and many books relating to the Talmud, so commentaries, all sorts of other books, were burnt in Rome in a massive bonfire. And the Talmud was then forbidden from being printed in Italy, ever. It was on the index of prohibited books from the beginning, and one was not allowed to print the Talmud because of its so-called heretical nature. About a year later, on May 29th, 1554, the Pope said, okay, you still can't print the Talmud, but you could print other Jewish works on the condition that a censor, somebody who's hired by the Catholic Church, often a convert from Judaism to Christianity, but not always, has to review the work. And as you can see in the center, sign his name at the end of the work, indicating that he has read that book and has not found anything offensive in it. As you can see, sometimes they found lots that was offensive. And sometimes, here's also a whole bunch. Sometimes it was just a word. Some censors actually, I have the soft cover, highly recommend. The soft cover is just fine. but sometimes the censors didn't know very much. They would just look for the word goy, for instance. Goy sometimes is referring to the Jewish people as a goy kadosh, as a holy nation, for instance. But just because it had the word goy, they would cross it out because they didn't really know how to read Hebrew that well, or they didn't know the context that well. So some censors were more or less educated. The other thing about censorship is that the ink that the censors use was not of great quality. As you can see, the ink that was used in printing was a lot stronger. So with time, the censor's ink has faded and we can see almost highlighted. You can see here as it looks like it's been highlighted, the work that was crossed out. So instead of obscuring the work, our attention is actually drawn to it. And we can start to learn about what the censors thought would be questionable and try to understand why or what would be problematic. Sometimes it's very obvious, sometimes it's less so. But censors actually, like I said, there's a little bit of a silver lining involved here. So censors were remarkably careful about how they signed their books. So they didn't just sign, sometimes they did. So in this case, it says Domenico Yerushalmitano. This was the name of the censor. He was a convert from Judaism. His last name was Yerushalmi. So when you Latinize that, it becomes Yerushalmitano. And he reviewed this work in 1598. So because we know where Domenico Yerushalmitano was operating in 1598, we can identify this work as having been, I believe it's Mantua for this one, in that particular year. So suddenly the census marks, the census signatures, give us a tremendous amount of information as to where and when the book was. And that's where Shifra Barachson, whose article I mentioned earlier on the number of books in Jewish homes in Italy, she gets her information from looking at censors' inventories of the books that they went, of the homes that they went to, of the, and then of the books that they looked at. And they hit pretty much every home in Italy and in the particular town that they were working in. I think she, her work is particularly on Mantua, if I recall correctly. There were other cities that employed censors. And sometimes a censor would look at a book in one year, this is 1626, and then here's 1598, 1626 went above it, this looks like 1613. So the books would have to be submitted and resubmitted and resubmitted. So you can, I can conclusively say that this book was in, if these three censors were operating in the same city, I could say that it was in that city between 1598 and 1626, which actually gives me quite a range of time of the ownership of this book. I don't know who the owner is, but I know where it was owned. I know in what community it was owned. So I can get all sorts of information just by looking at the censor's marks. Censors, however, were not only, oh, I'm sorry. In many cases, we find that Jews weren't so great about keeping out the censored works, as you might imagine. If somebody else came into your house and said, you're not allowed to read this book, and that somebody else didn't care about your religion and you cared deeply about your religion, you might add back the text. In fact, if you look at this Selichot, you see that it was crossed out. This whole thing was crossed out, but somebody wrote on the margin sort of a little reminder of what they should be saying. So even though it was crossed out, the text was still remembered. And we see many, many examples of this. Aleinu, for instance, the prayer Aleinu often has a phrase that's taken out about non-Jews worshiping gods that help them not, that do not help them. And that text in many books is then written back in. We have a manuscript, actually, because they looked at both manuscripts and printed books. There was no distinction between whether something was from, you know, a 500 years old or whether it was printed yesterday. If it was heretical, it was heretical. And so books as famous as the Sarajevo Haggadah has, I think, more than one censor's mark in the back of it, because somebody went through it and marked up that this text was acceptable. And they didn't cross out, you know, Shvuch Chametcha al Hagoyim, like venture anger on the Goyim, because the censor probably didn't know what those words were. And yet they signed it. And so we see all of this. We see what these censors were doing and how the Jews would add the text back in. And so in this case, this is a book currently at the Yeshiva University. The censor, this is already later. This is in 1754. So this is after censorship has been around for quite some time. The censor writes a long paragraph that essentially stating that if anybody adds back in the text that I have removed, the owner of the book will be held accountable. So the owner of the book was responsible for any of those illegal passages to be added back in, because this was something that Jews were doing all the time. Censorship, like I started to say, was not only done by Christians. In this case, this is a book that was printed this was a Hebrew book printed by Christians in Izni in 1541. And I rewrote here what was crossed out because the year that it's given here is the year of the coming of our Messiah and our Redeemer, Yeshua, Jesus. And it goes through, and that's from the year of the Common Era. And so the owner of this particular book, who was Jewish, didn't want this piece here because that was Christological. And they didn't want a book in their house that would indicate that Jesus was the Messiah, because sort of for obvious reasons. And so they crossed out the entire text of that piece. So it wasn't only Christians that would cross out these works. Somebody asked, how did censors gain access to privately owned books? So I think it's important to remember that during this period, Jews were not free. Jews were allowed to live sort of by the benevolence of the ruling party. The ruling party was often in Italy was Catholic. And if the Catholic Church said you have to submit your books to the censor, they had to submit their books to the censor. There was no choice in the matter. There was no sort of freedom of anything. So the censor would actually, sometimes they would have to bring their books to the Inquisition. Sometimes the censors would come to the homes. It's not quite clear, but the books, they didn't have a choice. They, private or not private, if you cannot own this book, and so we're gonna make sure that you don't own this book. I should mention that for Christians, there were also books that were censored, but they were given sort of a guidebook where they were expected to cross out the passages themselves. So a particular book was printed. The church would put out some information saying on page 52, this phrase needs to be crossed out. And they trusted their Christian congregants to do it on their own. They did not trust the Jews to cross out passages that would have been offensive to Christianity. And as we saw from that that notice saying, stop adding back in the things we've crossed out, they sort of had good reason for that. I'm just going to answer one of the questions in the comments about Rashi script. Rashi did not write in Rashi script. The script that currently that is used for Rashi and other commentaries is based on a Spanish semi-cursive handwriting. Rashi never would have used it. He was French and German, depending on the year and where those places were owned by. But this is a case of the printers making decisions that then have persisted into the present day. So the main text, when a printer was printing a Bible, for instance, the main text of the Bible, the sacred text of the Bible, was written in a form that was similar to Ketav HaShiri, what would be written in the Sefer Torah. So that would be a square font. And then they needed to distinguish between the sacred text and the commentary on the text. So for the commentary, they decided to use this this font that comes from a Spanish semi-cursive, and that's where the so-called Rashi script emanated from. It was not developed by Rashi at all. Somebody asked about praenumerantin lists. Praenumerantin is a fairly late phenomenon. It comes out in the late 18th century. And there's a wonderful project called Hamapa that again, I've talked earlier about how we're tracing all of these names. Praenumerantin lists is another way to find names. They were essentially an early modern Kickstarter. Somebody wanted to print a book. They couldn't afford to print the book. So they sent out, they asked for subscriptions to the book. They said, if you subscribe to my book, so you send me money in advance, I'll have enough money, I'll print my book. And you'll get a copy of the book because you've essentially paid for the book in advance. So you get it. So it's literally the same concept as Kickstarter. And then in the front of the book, just like in a Kickstarter project, sometimes, well, they don't always do it, but sometimes you'll see all of the funders of the project. So the praenumerantin were the subscription list, the lists of subscribers to a particular book. So from praenumerantin lists, we can see the fame of an author or the interest in a particular topic, because people were willing to pay in advance without seeing the book. Sometimes they had a portion of them, a couple of pages, just as a summary, almost like a trailer for the book, so that you could see sort of what it was going to look like. And then you could decide whether you wanted to buy it in advance. Okay. Sorry, I just getting distracted by the chat a bit. So I just want to talk a little bit about what Footprints is, because it all of these, sorry, we've been collecting all of this information. It's a project that's co-directed by four people, myself, Josh Toplitsky, who's at Stony Brook, Adam Shear, who's at the University of Pittsburgh, and Marjorie Lehman, who's at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And the four of us have started this project, but we have collaborators from around the world. It's a volunteer project. We're volunteers on the project. But we have people, like I said, somebody like Eli Genauer, who lives in Seattle. He has a private collection, and he has been sending us data from his collection. We have national libraries that have sent us data from their collections. And in recent years, the importance of identifying all of this data and the amount that we can learn from all of this data has become just clearer and clearer. I attended a symposium at UCLA that focused on books that were returned to a museum and a library in Prague, because UCLA started looking closely at, because they had digitized their book, and this institution, their books had been looted by the Nazis, and they were looking at digitized materials, and they found their materials. And so then UCLA ended up returning the books. So this is something that libraries are increasingly aware of and are mindful of. So I hope that I've made it clear over the course of this class, and especially tonight's class, that books have lives, books tell stories. I hope that I've inspired you to look a little closer at the books in your own collection, and perhaps to see what stories you can uncover or leave behind. I should say, I always write in my books my name, the date I acquired it, and where I got it from, because, as you might imagine, this is something I have the arrogance to think that people in the future might be interested in who used my books, because obviously I care a lot about this concept. So I'll end there. I'm not sure if there were any additional questions.
I didn't have any questions. No, it's a small world. Well, I hope someone will ask questions. But Josh Toplitsky, Dr. Josh Toplitsky, was my student about 22 years ago when I first started teaching in Toronto. I taught him at Or Chaim, and he was in who turned out to be one of his classmates, married my niece. They now live in Efrat, but he was a great student. And of course, he's done amazing stuff. I know he did writes on the book, and I was very interested, but it's very, of course, I know the family anyways. I just figured I couldn't resist when you mentioned his name. And just at the end, of course, I had a smile, and thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it's not 6 degrees with Jewish connections. I see somebody wrote, when I was a student for Smicha at Yeshiva University and in the PhD program and history at Columbia, you were shocked to find a small Rashba from around 1700 in the library. I hope you alerted people to that fact. The thing about Columbia's library is that Columbia was founded in 1754, and it was collecting books since 1754. So when the Rare Book and Manuscript Library was established in the early 1900s, they tried to get the majority of those rare books out of the stacks, but there were a lot of books. So they didn't quite get everything. And as recently as a few years ago, I did a survey of the stacks to pull additional books. The Rare Book School, which is a program that's now at the University of Virginia, began at Columbia, and Terry Bellinger, who led Rare Book School, used to always give his students the assignment to go through the Columbia stacks to find rare books in the stacks. I think we've gotten a lot better. I hope that you wouldn't find a book from 1700 there anymore, but one never knows. If you do, please give it to the, please have us put it somewhere safer.
I did have a desk in the stacks. And matter of fact, I remember I was learning Gemara Sanhedrin, and that Rashba was a small volume, was on Sanhedrin.
It was perfect.
I don't recall. I mean, just about 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, many times sitting in the stacks, I get bored and just walk around.
Yeah.
And I just saw that and it just blew my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. I have the great fortune to be able to go through the rare stacks and periodically pull books off shelves. And I can tell you my mind is blown every time. it's really a wonderful collection, a wonderful historic collection. Somebody asked about an annotated bibliography. I don't have it all together at once. What I can do is I can send it to Rabbi Kelman.
That's a great idea.
And if you can see who's registered for the course, if you want to just
send it. Yeah, it's a great idea. That's what I was going to say. I can send up an email to everybody who registered for the for the class. Yeah, no problem.
Okay, great.
Okay, anybody else? But otherwise, I want to thank you very much. Pleasure to meet you and to learn with you and to hear from you. And thank you. And Yashar Koach. Okay, tomorrow morning, Marty Lakshin continues his class on the Parsha Mishpatim, the Covenant Code, 11 a.m. And at 1 p.m., Rabbi Moshe Shulman continues his series on Midrash, Unlocking Midrash. And last week he was testing Brushy's use of Midrashim. And then tomorrow night, Dr. Sokolow continues with his Tamei HaMitzvot. I believe he's up to the Rambam tomorrow night, if I'm not mistaken. That's at 8 p.m. tomorrow night. And then Thursday, Benny Gesundheit gets part two of his always fascinating original creative series on Shavuot. I think it's Maimonides curriculum for school, I believe is the topic for this week. And then Thursday night, the Parsha Shira will be given by Shira Hech Kohler. And I'll be giving my regular weekly shir on the Siddur 9:35 on Friday morning. So we look forward to learning with you and your friends. And okay, all the best. And Michelle, thank you very much once again. And enjoy and all the best. Okay, Lila Tov, everybody. Thank you.